Welcome to Wildlife Outdoors with your hosts, Russell and Jose. If you have a passion for conservation of the outdoors, or you're enjoying a calming hike in the mountains, an exhilarating kayak trip on the river, feeling a fish on the end of your line, cooking on an open flame in a primitive campsite, or stalking big game, just waiting for the perfect shot, you're in the right place. So put on your boots and polarized sunglasses and come along for the ride.
Howdy, guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Wildlife Outdoor Podcast. Today, it's just Russell and I. We're doing a quick little snapshot episode over cicadas. Fun fact, I actually know absolutely nothing about cicadas, but Russell has been doing quite a bit of research, and he's pretty excited to share what he found with everybody, considering the cicada hatches upon us, if I'm not mistaken. So I'll kick it over to you, Russell, and let's share some fun facts.
Yeah, man, it's gonna be a pretty interesting late spring, early summer through a lot of the U.S. It doesn't happen very often, but there's going to be two periodical cicada hatches at the same time, which are going to be a 17-year brood and a 13-year brood, which is going to be brood 19 and brood 13. Oddly enough, brood 13 is a 17-year strain, so okay. Kind of gets okay. A little convoluted there.
Hold on. I have to interrupt. Sorry, I didn't mean to. But okay, so what do you mean by broods and the different numbers associated with them?
So there are different... I guess groups. So they're numbered broods, and there are like 15 active broods right now, 12 active broods of 17 years and 3 active broods of 13 years. So basically what it means is the cicadas stay in a larval stage for 17 or 13 years, which before I started doing research, I just thought like eggs would hatch or whatever. Like I didn't know much about it. I was like, oh, they just come every 13 or 17 years. And no, they're in a larval stage for that long. So a 17-year brood is in a larval stage for 17 years before they hatch. And so they go from that larval stage, they climb trees, fences. And so everybody's seen the little hollow husks of cicadas when they hatch. That's them transitioning from larval stage to adult stage. And then they're an adult for a season. So it's crazy to think about that they're living underground, eating roots of shrubs and trees and stuff like that for 17 years or 13 years.
So hold on. So they're in a larval stage for that long, and then their adult life cycle is a year?
Yep.
Dude, what the heck?
Kind of sucks, could you, right?
Could you imagine like us, we live 13 years as babies, and then we automatically, like one day we wake up, we're an adult, and then we live for like a year and then we're dead. That's
Dude, that would wild. Suck. That would suck. But yeah, that's how it is for them. Of course, there is the annual cicadas as well. So these are the cicadas, the periodical ones are the ones that are black with red eyes. You'll see a little bit of brown on them. Those are the cicadas we're talking about here. The other cicadas, the green ones that you see every year, those are called annual cicadas, or a lot of people call them dog day cicadas. And those are ones that are just constantly going off spring and summertime. And those come every year. So slightly different, but basically the same bug. They look different and whatnot. So like if you see flies that are tied in cicada patterns for areas and times when there's going to be a brood hatch, normally they're tying darker colors. But if you want to tie a cicada pattern that's for like an every year cicada, dog day cicada, it's just going to be green. So that's how you can tell the difference between the annual and the periodical. But this year is a special year where we're going to have two broods hatching at the same time, one of which is the largest brood, which is brood 19. And they're going to be all over Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Louisiana, Missouri, Mississippi, North Carolina, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, a little bit in the Texas Panhandle. Like they're going to be everywhere. And so a lot of people are thinking, oh, well, there's going to be cicadas because there's two broods. Unfortunately, that's not the case. So there are going to be two broods, but the second brood is a 17-year brood. It's brood 13, and they're mainly going to be in the Midwest. So they're going to be Iowa, Illinois, Wisconsin, possibly Michigan, but majority of them are going to be Illinois. Illinois is ground zero for both brood 19 and brood 13 hatching at the same time. So they're going to have millions, billions even, possibly trillions of cicadas hatching, not in Illinois, but in total this year.
Yeah. Dude, that's interesting. I got a few different questions. So the broods, are they based on regions? Like you mentioned a lot was in the South. So are there other regions for like Pacific Northwest and whatever?
I haven't seen any in the Pacific Northwest. It seems like most cicadas are from the center of the U.S. towards the East Coast. So it's majority from the South, Southeast to the Northeast and kind of towards like, you know, Illinois and Michigan and kind of more towards the Midwest. I didn't see too many broods that extended out further west in the map that I saw. So they are regional, but some of the regions overlap. And that's when you get, you know, Illinois, for instance, this year with 13 and 19 hatching.
So what does that mean for, I guess, for a for the average person? Like, what should they expect? And then I know there's a lot of people. Okay. Well, I mean, yeah. So like, I know there's a lot of people like kind of freaking out, like, I don't know, making it this huge deal. But is it one, do you think it's really as big of a deal as people make it out to be? And then what does that mean for like the fishermen? Cause I've seen a lot of people in the fly fishing groups, like freaking out saying how this year is going to be epic for fishing and stuff. So what does that all mean?
So for human interaction, from everything that I've seen, is it's not going to make too much of a difference. I mean, cicadas are non-toxic to humans. They don't bite. They're not going to kill anybody. They're not going to make anybody sick. In terms of human interaction, it's just going to be loud. Like, you're just going to hear a bunch of buzzing, basically. So it's not going to be too bad. When it comes to fishermen, in areas where there's a large population of cicadas, that's going to be the food. So you know what the fish are going to be eating. And as a fly fisherman, there's nothing better than a good topwater take. So if you know cicadas are in the area and they're falling on top of the water and you're throwing a cicada pattern, I mean, you know you're going to get some topwater takes. So that's always going to be exciting. So it's kind of more of, you know, matching the hatch. You kind of know what's going to be there because you know that this brood is going to hatch here. So it wouldn't hurt to have some cicada patterns in your box, but it doesn't really make too much of a difference. It's not going to make a huge impact on everyday life for most people. It's weird, though, how it kind of, like, looking historically, I guess they started collecting data about 200 years ago, you know, studying around the broods of cicadas and whatnot. And it's weird how it almost seems the year before the cicadas are going to hatch in a region, the bird populations are lower. And so they haven't exactly found out why cicadas only hatch or go from larval stage to adult stage every 13 or 17 years for said brood. They haven't figured out why. They just know it's a part of their life cycle, and they've started to realize that there are actually other conditions that go into it. Bird populations dropped the year before and stuff like that. So it's pretty interesting to see how it's all, you know, intertwined, kind of like how Steve said last week, how everything, you know, goes together. But there's all these fluctuations in populations of other animals, whether they be predators or seemingly unrelated to cicada populations, how they kind of seem to ebb and flow in the same pattern as cicadas do. So it's pretty interesting. So it makes a big difference on the animal kingdom. But in terms of human interaction, it's not going to make, you know, anything crazy for anybody.
Dude, that's so interesting, man. The fact that the bird populations are lower before they hatch, I wonder what it looks like after, if they just kind of like swarm, if they can feel like or assess those changes.
Yeah. And that's what they were thinking originally, is they were thinking that the cicadas could tell and then they would hatch. But now they're starting to see that normally what happens is it just seems like the bird populations are naturally going through their ebbs and flows. And the cicadas over time, over the past, you know, millennia, they have, you know, realized that their populations do better, you know, natural selection, their populations do better when they hatch at these certain times when bird populations are in the low. So I don't think it's anything that's a cognitive thing with the cicadas that they're like, oh, there's less birds, let's hatch. It's just kind of something over the years that has just kind of, you know, gone through the cycle.
That's pretty cool, man. So have you, in your research, have you come across anything about a cicada hatch maybe affecting like farmers and crop damage and things like that?
I didn't look into agriculture. I'm sure that there has to be, you know, something, because I know that when they're in their larval stage, they'll eat, you know, root balls of shrubbery. In the adult stages, I would assume that they would probably eat plants or foliage above ground. So I would assume in areas where there's high populations of them, they probably will have some agricultural effects, but I didn't look anything up specifically for that. I was, you know, looking more into fishing stuff just because I'm like, should I tie up some cicada patterns?
So I guess to that end, did you come across any cicada patterns? Like,
yeah, there's a few. So I've seen quite a few different ones, and there's, you know, some very similar to like a dito popper, where you just kind of use some 2 or 3 millimeter foam, double them up, fold them over, tie them down type of thing. I've seen some real intricate ones to where you'll actually do foam wraps, different colors, you know, put some ribbing on it, add legs, add wings. I've seen, you know, just typical polyfiber wings. I've seen some actual, like, they look like real cicada wings. Some people taking bead-headed pins and putting them on the side to look like the red eyes. Like, there's some real intricate patterns out there, and then there's some basically guide fly patterns out there. But I'm sure they all do the job, you know?
Yeah, dude. I've seen some videos on Instagram of, I can't think of their names now, but dude, they were tying some really awesome ones. Like, they looked so good. And then I tried to tie one using deer hair. And it was terrible. I just got mad, and I just took a razor blade and cut it off the hook because it just looked so bad, which is unfortunate. That was a waste of material. But yeah, I've never actually, aside from that one deer hair cicada, I've never actually tried to tie a cicada. But I feel like I should, especially if this year being the year, then I probably definitely should. As should a lot of you guys who are planning on going fishing the cicada hatch.
I tried to tie one up, and so I don't know if you remember, I posted a picture of a woolly bugger I tied probably like a week or two ago.
Yes.
That was like my second fly because I was so pissed off. I was getting so angry. I have not tied, well, other than with iron fly. I hadn't tied prior to that in a few years. And so I tied a woolly bugger and then a Frankenstein of a fly at iron fly. And then the other night, a couple weeks ago, I was like, oh, I'm going to try to tie up a cicada pattern. And dude, it came out horrible. I was trying to my defense, I was trying to make an intricate one, and I just couldn't do it. And they didn't have the foam that I wanted at Hobby Lobby. And so I just got some other foam that I thought could make it work. And it wasn't turning out well at all. And so I got a little aggravated, and I cut everything off the hook and said, screw it. I'm going to change the hook. And I'm going to tie a freaking woolly bugger so I can at least put a picture on the website. Like, dude, it was ugly. I should have taken a picture of it to make fun of myself because, dude, it was ugly. Like, a fish may have bit it. I probably could have caught some type of bluegill on it, but yeah, not a picky fish.
Dude, I don't know, man. Like, I feel that fish really aren't as well. Within reason, I think trout can be very, very picky. So can like the bigger bass and stuff. But I think within reason, I really don't think they care at times. Like, dude, I went fishing with a friend one time. I wasn't fly fishing, but he threw a bear hook one time and caught a bass. Like, literally caught a bass on a bear hook. So And then we ran out of bait one time fishing, and we just had like some gum. So we put gum on a hook and we were catching fish off that thing. So I really don't think, and then if you look at like Bass Pro and you walk through the conventional stuff, I mean, they got all kinds of crazy stuff, crazy colors, big, small, don't matter. I really don't think fish care a lot of the time. There are instances like maybe where it's super pressured or very clear waters and things like that, where, or if they're keying in on like something specific, like trout keying in on a hatch or something, they're, you know, it has to look a certain way or ride a certain way or, you know, present itself in a certain way. I think in those instances, I think it makes a big difference. But I've tied some like horrendous flies, and I can go kill some, like just kill it in the pond next door. So, I mean, it's funny. Fish are funny that way, I guess.
I've tied some pretty bad flies and caught some fish. Hell, you remember that one time we were out there at the some body of water in Central Texas, and we ran out of bait back when we were conventional fishermen.
Oh, yes.
I caught a good-sized catfish on a dip.
Instantaneous.
Yep.
Like,
yeah, that just had to be the smell.
that or just happened to be passing by right when you dropped it in the water.
Right.
I don't know. Cause it was like instant. It was wild.
Yep. The second it hit the water. Dude, did I tell you about the time that Adeline caught a fish on a bear hook?
No, I don't think you have.
Dude. So this was probably, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago or so. And I went out to my buddy Matt's aunt's house, and she lives over off the lake here in Hot Springs. And he's like, yeah, man, we're just going to sit. And her backyard goes up to the water. He's like, we're just going to sit in the backyard and, you know, maybe cook some hot dogs, drink some beer and fish. I said, all right. And so we went over there, and it was him. It was my buddy Matt, his cousin Mike, his son, me, and Adeline. And Adeline was, you know, what, 3, 4 at the time. And she had this little Moana push button rod and reel. And Matt was using worms. He was using chicken liver. He was using hot dogs. He was using all sorts of stuff, live bait or like bait. And then he started throwing like Cinco's and rattle traps, buzz baits, crank baits, like throwing all these other, you know, conventional fishing gear, just trying to get something, not catching anything. I was throwing every fly I had in my box and was not catching anything, not a bluegill, not bass, nothing, not seeing any. And I've seen white bass run through there, and it was around that time of year too. And just, I mean, nothing. Well, Adeline had gotten restless. She was out there for 30 minutes or so, gotten restless, had gone inside and was playing inside. We're on like 11 o'clock at night. Like, I let her stay up late. She came out at 11 o'clock at night and wanted a fish. By that point, we'd already used all the worms and everything. And I said, all right, cool. And so I figured she just wanted to be out there with me. So I threw her bobber out there with a bear hook. 11 o'clock at night, and we're just standing there talking, and Adeline goes, daddy, I got one. And I thought she was hung up on something, you know? And I was like, I just threw a bear hook out there, and she starts reeling, and like drag is peeling on her little rod. And I look, and the end of it's bouncing, and I'm like, the heck? So I helped her reel it in, and she caught this huge freaking slab of a bluegill. And I was like, how in the heck? Like, we've been out here for 4 or 5 hours using everything we have to catch anything, haven't caught anything, and then she catches it on a bear hook. Like, come on now.
Dude, that's wild.
Dude, it was nuts.
It was acorns. But dude, I remember this one time. When I was doing my master's down at the college at I guess in South Texas, I had some friends, and one of them had a house near the coast. I mean, it was like on the coast. It was on Baffin Bay. And it had a private pier. He always told me, he's like, yeah, man, if you ever want to go out there fish anytime, you know, just let me know or whatever. And every Wednesday we would also go to his place, and it was like kind of like family night where we would take turns bringing food or cooking food. And we all just, it was a few of us, we'd all sit there and have dinner, and then we'd go fishing afterwards. So this was one of those nights we all went out there, we had dinner, and then we were just kind of hanging around talking, and we went fishing. And the bite got really, really slow, and it was getting really, really late. So everybody kind of went inside. But my buddy who owned the place, he's like, yeah, man, you know, just, you know, you can stay out here as long as you want. I really don't care. Just turn the pier lights off when you leave. It's like, all right, cool. So I stayed out there, man. And it was one of the first times that I was really trying to learn how to fly fish. And it was one of the first times I took my fly rod to the pier to go fishing. And before that, I had been using it while everybody else was using conventional gear, and they were like out fishing me like 10 to one, you know. I think I maybe caught one or two fish while I was out there. And so I ended up putting the fly rod away, just picked up the conventional stuff and started catching fish, whatever, but they went away. And so I just stayed out there. I was really trying to practice my cast, and I had this little, I don't even know what to call it. I guess it was like a shrimp imitation. I'm not really sure, but it had a bunch of little rubber legs. It had some chenille. It's very, very simple. Like, it wasn't overly extravagant. I bought it off eBay, I think, for like, I don't know, $3 for like 5 of them. And so it was very, very cheap. That's how I used to buy my flies when I was first getting into it, because, you know, that was cheap and I really didn't know what I was doing or anything. So I just bought those. So I had like these little weird little rubber legs, and I had some chenille, very simple. So I started using that, and dude, I don't know what happened, but the bite just turned on. I was cleaning up. I probably by myself that night caught, I don't know, easily over 50 fish, dude. It was insane. Just, I mean, and then some keeper trout, speckled trout, sorry, not rainbows or brown, speckled trout, and a bunch of like undersized. But dude, by the end of it, it was essentially like a bear hook. It had lost all its rubber legs. The chenille was like barely there. It still had the little dumbbell eyes. But dude, for whatever reason, the fish did not care. They were just smacking that thing. It was awesome. Eventually I just retired the fly, and I got tired, so I just put it up while the getting was good, and I just went out the pier, turned out the lights, went home. But dude, it was one of the most epic nights of fishing I've ever had. And I was telling my friends about it the next day, like, oh dude, you're full of crap, and that didn't happen. I was like, bro, I promise you. And but yeah, dude, it was insane. So like, even though like it's the fly started off looking good, by the end of it, man, it was hardly anything, but it was still wrecking it. It was awesome.
That's insane. Dude, I've never caught a speckled trout on the fly yet.
It's fun, man. It's a lot of fun. Actually, fly fishing, I feel like fly fishing, well, it's hard around like the public piers, especially when there's a lot of people around, because there's just so many lines in the water, and sometimes the piers get so packed, everyone's together. But every now and again, you'll go out there on a night where there's just not that many. I feel like because flies are lighter and typically smaller, they work better. Like I've had some nights where people weren't catching anything and I was just catching fish on my fly rod because it was just different from what everybody else was throwing.
Yeah. Dude, that's kind of how it was this last July when I was up in Alaska. You know, I went with my brother-in-law and their friend, and they were all using conventional gear and stuff. And I think I outfished them probably, I think I caught 8-10 fish that night. And I think they caught one total between the three of them. And that was on a lake, surprisingly. I've never had luck on a lake before.
Dude, lakes are tough for me, man. I've never fished a lake like off a boat or anything with a fly rod. I've only ever fished a lake with conventional gear. But even then, man, it was just so different. I remember my buddy, he had just gotten this really nice, I think it was a Skeeter bass boat, and he took me fishing on a lake in Austin, and we found some fish. The fishing was really slow, but then it heated up and it got really, really good. We caught a bunch of bass that day. But then he invited me another time to go to Falcon Lake, which is the biggest lake I've ever fished. And there were some monster bass in there. Some monster gator guard too. I saw some huge ones. But dude, that, like, it was just so different to me, man. Fishing like 30 foot of water, like even with a jig, it's just crazy. Like I just could not figure it out. I think I ended up getting one bite. And then when I set the hook, it broke off. So at some point, I like nicked my line. And when I set the hook, it was just gone. And but dude, it was tough fishing. We all got skunked. That place was tough. For me, lake fishing, dude, it's just, and even big river fishing, I think, can be really tough for me just because I don't do it a lot. Like when we went to the White, man, that place was, like, if we didn't have a guide, I wouldn't know what to do, what to look for or nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely prefer small water myself. I fished a few tournaments in lakes and whatnot, and some of the tournaments that I was fishing there for a while were for Central Arkansas kayak anglers, and so there's conventional guys out there. Some guys throwing Alabama rigs, and I'm out there with my fly rod, and so it's been tough, you know, going against conventional and freaking Alabama rigs. I mean, hell, can you imagine? So I've placed in a couple tournaments, third place, fourth place typically. Third, fourth, fifth are like where I typically stay. We need to get a fly tournament somehow going, because that would be fun to do. Going against conventional,
Yeah. Well, you and I have talked about trying to figure out how we can host like fly fishing, like one fly tournament or multi-species tournament or something. We just, because Rob, I think that was the episode we had with Rob where he was about to go to a multi-species tournament.
Yeah, we're like, in Texas.
I'd be like, man, that'd be cool to make one before like everybody, you know, like have like all
we
my
should for sure. We should definitely get going on that, try to get something planned out and do.
Dude, that'd be sick. It's just the logistics of how it would all work out. Keeping
right,
people,
you have to look at species and where people are at, you know.
Yeah, and regionality has a huge impact. So
yep. You know, I mean, obviously if we do it in the summertime, you're not gonna be catching trout in Texas, but there's areas of Arkansas you can catch them. So
yeah,
you know, you wouldn't want to be doing stuff like that. We'd probably have to do like a warm water species tournament in the summer or spring, and then maybe we could do a different one for like cold water species in the winter.
We could do that, or we could do each, I guess, fish will have a different weight assigned to it. Like, we can go by, I guess, but it'd be hard though, because like with region, for example, in a region where rainbow trout are common, like they can have a one or something. Same for like largemouth bass, and then I don't know, tarpon could be like five or whatever, and then.
Yeah,
I don't know, but then it gets more complicated because of,
well, you'd have to have something equally weighted. For instance, you're not going to catch tarpon if you're not on the coast. So if there's going to be 5 points for a tarpon, we'd have to do 5 points for mirror carp or something that you can catch somewhere else than the coast, you know.
But that's still
difficult to catch.
And we'd have to do a ton of research. Like, yeah it was just, I don't know.
We can get something going though.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. Something. We'll figure something out. Yeah. But yeah, man. So we're coming up at 20 something odd minutes now. We're trying to keep these snapshots short. So we talked about a little bit about fly time, cicadas. Anything else we should touch on?
I would say events, but by the time this episode comes out, the pickerel tournament is going to be over. They're doing a pickerel tournament. It's Thursday now. This Sunday, they're doing a pickerel tournament. I'm not going to be able to go, unfortunately. But yeah, so here in Arkansas, so hopefully those of y'all that did the pickerel tournament that already know about it here in Arkansas, I believe on Lower Lake De Grey, hopefully they did a good job, caught some fish, maybe won a tournament, won some money. I don't know. I'm not gonna be able to make it to it, but I think it's gonna be the second year in a row I haven't made it to that tournament, and I love catching me some pickerel.
Still need to catch one. Still want to catch one. There's a place in Texas you can. But speaking of events in here in Texas, we have Trout Fest in New Braunfels this weekend. I know our buddies Marco and Danny are going to be there, and I've seen some posts from some other folks that are going. I don't know if I'm going to be going yet or not. I would like to.
Yeah,
maybe I'll make it my homework and report back to this podcast how it all went down. But
you should. Yeah. When is it?
It's this weekend. So Friday, I think they're having like a banquet or something. And then Saturday, they're having, I guess, the actual expo. So they're going to have a bunch of different, like, different things going on that day. And it's all free, too, which is cool. I think the only things you pay for, obviously, is anything that you buy there. And then the tickets for the banquet and they're showing a fly fishing film, or I don't know if it's a film or a series of films, but they're having like a movie night on Saturday evening, if I'm not mistaken. But tickets are already sold out for that, from what I've seen. So if I go, I will not make it to either of those, but I will try to go to the expo on Saturday. And I think Sunday there's some events going on too. I know Danny is going, I think he said he's going Friday night for the banquet. I think he's going Sunday. I don't know what day Marco's going, but I might go by and check it out, because I've never been to Trout Fest. It'd be cool. I know for the Honey Hole Hates Trash event, one of the winners, or the winner who won the fly, the hand tied flies from us, actually met them, gave them the flies. Really cool, really, really, really cool people. And I think he said they were going to go. And so it'd be cool to run into them there. And I think, I can't remember who else off the top of my head. There's going to be a lot of people there. So it'd be a really cool event. And unfortunately, whoever's listening to this, the event would have already passed by the time you do. But if anybody is listening to this who attended Trout Fest, we would love to hear what the experience was like for you guys. You know, so reach out to us, and it'd be cool to kind of pass that along for next year in case anybody is interested in that.
Absolutely. Isn't Zach Harris going to be there? He's going to be one of the tires there or something like that?
Something like that. I feel like some of the Honey Hole guys are going to be there. I'm not sure, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I wish I could make it down. I honestly didn't even know it was coming up this weekend. So
yeah, I didn't either. I just dude, I know. This whole, like, I don't know, things have been so crazy here lately. I just lost track of all that stuff, and I saw something about it not too long ago. I was like, oh, that's cool. I might actually be in town for that. So we'll see.
Nice.
Yeah, seriously.
Well, that'll work. Well, we're coming up on half an hour, and I guess that's where we're trying to keep the snapshots at. So is there anything else you want to talk about before we close her out?
No, just hope you guys have a good weekend. And thanks again for tuning in. Always a pleasure. And if you have, you know, follow us on socials, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube now as well.
TikTok.
And if you guys have any questions, comments, concerns, any kind of feedback, we'd love to hear from y'all. So thanks again for tuning in. And just till next time.
We'll catch y'all next time.
This has been Wildlife Outdoors. Thanks for listening. Follow us on Facebook at Wildlife Outdoors and on Instagram at wild.life.outdoors. Let's go live life on the wild side.